from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up next on Forum, Bay Area author Fred Setterberg joins us to talk about Lunch Bucket Paradise, which he has subtitled a true life novel. It's set in the 50s and 60s in a blue-collar neighborhood based on his boyhood coming of age in a neighborhood in San Leandro. Forum is next. Join us for the hour after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the second hour of our Forum program this morning. Award-winning Bay Area-based author and journalist Fred Setterberg joins us in studio for this morning's second hour. Author of The Roads Taken, Travels Through America's Literary Landscape, which won the AWP Prize in Creative Nonfiction. He also co-wrote Under the Dragon, California's New Culture, and edited Traveler's Tales America. His essays and reporting have appeared in the Iowa Review, the Southern Review, New York Times, The Nation, and Utney Reader. And he's former staff writer for the East Bay Express. His newest book, a novel, is called Lunch Bucket Paradise, which he subtitled a true life novel. And it takes us back to the 50s and 60s and the working class world of Northern California suburbia. Fred Setterberg joins us in studio for this Forum Hour. Good to have you.
Thank you, Michael. I'm glad to be here.
Well, welcome. This is really a different world of the working class. It's funny, we did a program, and I was remembering it, on the census of 1948. And you had all these people living in working-class neighborhoods in San Francisco who were able to afford houses then, mm-hmm. Who were doing factory-type work or electricians or whatever. And the fact is, of course, that world has changed. But people could afford homes then, and the homes were very important to them. And you capture that quite well here. Why do you call this a true life novel, though? You could have called it a memoir almost, couldn't you?
Well, that was the temptation, and it was one I wanted to resist. If it were to be a memoir, then I would want it actually to be all true. And so much of this is imagined. It's invented. There is one major exception, and that's the character of Franklin, who is the father of the narrator. I should first say that the book looks like a memoir. It's an unidentified first-person narrator. The book covers about 20 years, from 1950 to 1970.
You weren't called slick as a boy?
No, I was not.
Okay. And Franklin had tuberculosis? I mean, all that was true.
Yeah, that's the great exception with the book. Franklin, the father, really is my dad, Spencer. And anybody who knew him would see him, I think, in the language and the rhythms of his speech and also his biography. Born in Canada, went back to Norway, back to Canada, finally came to the U.S. A family of farmers who would routinely go bust in Canada, come down to the U.S., go bust during the Depression, and end up in the Bay Area because of all the work that came here during the war.
Was your mother Protestant, and did your father go after your mother as mother Catholic, excuse me, your father went after her with his Protestant?
Yes. My mom was an Italian Catholic from Calabria. She married this unimaginable Protestant skeptic who liked to lure in the Jehovah's Witnesses on Sunday to debate them about evolution.
By the way, our fathers had that in common. Uh-huh. My father liked to do the same thing. They would come around with their magazines, and he would wind up getting in these arguments with them. I said, Dad, why are you doing this?
But he liked ruining their day.
Yeah. I mean, they thought they were there to save him, and that's how things turn out. But this is a kind of a coming-of-age Bildungsroman. You know, we go from innocence to experience. It's a traditional novel in that sense, American novel.
Yes. Yes, I wanted to cover that period of time that I thought was ignored generally in literature and popular culture. I had always wanted to write about where I grew up in the East Bay because they were not John Cheever's affluent suburbs, and they weren't the entirely mythical world of Leave It to Beaver. It was a rougher place in all those senses of the word because in 1950, when the book begins, we aren't yet a suburban nation. It's in process. It's becoming. And I remember as a kid climbing up over the back of our fence, and I'd look over and there were horses and cows because there were farms there. And at the other end of the street, where they would build a municipal park soon, there was a farm. And at the other end, for a variety, there was a farm. So it was a little patch of asphalt that was in an island of green still. And of course, you know, we know that's not the world today, but that continuous roll of suburbs that was indistinguishable one from the other was yet to come into the making. It was really more of a small town at that point.
It's going from the agrarian almost, or the quasi-agrarian, into the suburban, urban, suburban, or exurban, or right. All those words. Yeah. But there's also a sense of being in between in another way. The Second World War was over, and there's a lot of remembrances that go on, arguments about MacArthur and all that, right. About the Second World War, and kids playing war, and of course, the uncle, who plays a very important role in this novel, being sort of a heroic war figure to the boy. But there's also the Vietnam War up ahead, and yes. There's the Cold War, yes. Which of course, we were talking about in the last hour. And, you know, those of us who remember Duck and Cover and all that, there was a real sense of maybe we're going to be bombed by the Russians.
Right. Yeah, I was conscious once I finished writing it that I had bracketed the book between the two wars, between Vietnam and World War II, to different ends. I wanted to write about the way the catastrophe of World War II rose up from underneath those lawns and paved streets and really influenced the emotional life of America, but life in this working class suburb too, without it really being talked about explicitly. I mean, I remember very few times when the men in my family would talk about battles that they had been in, though everybody had been in the Pacific. It was a nightmare that they had internalized, and I think it came out in so many different ways, in the kind of casual violence that would erupt from time to time, and in the sense that I think is also class-bound, that things are going well today, but just you wait. There's a catastrophe around the corner, so get ready.
Well, there was that, but there was also, you know, it wasn't exactly happy days like the TV show, but there was a feeling that, things were pretty good, optimistic, never better for the working man, in fact.
That's right. And maybe that's why it ends in 1970, right? Because this is a period of expansion when wages are rising, when we've got retirement, pensions, the disability insurance, all these things that are helping people who had been, you know, bloodied by the war and bowed by the Depression. And now they were stepping into a world that of seeming, I won't say it seemed like infinite possibilities, but the possibility of moving into realms that they didn't yet know about. And, you know, these are the folks who, you know, would never step on a college campus themselves, but who routinely voted for the school bond issues and for members of the legislature who would build this great public education system for their kids and the kids around the block.
Well, you had the GI Bill, I mean, and not to mention FHA. I mean, you had some things that were really allowing for
right.
progress and movement forward. You also had racism and misogyny to a great degree. In fact, this is called Jefferson Manor, and we'll talk about that name because I was struck by it for a number of reasons. But it's really a place in San Leandro that came out of your own experience. And Brian Copeland, who happens to be a friend of mine, did a show, most popular, I guess, monologue has ever been done, the longest running in San Francisco history, about called Not a Genuine Black Man, which is also San Leandro. And, you know, the racism was palpable in San Leandro. He was a bit younger than you. But
he was 4 or 5 years younger. It was the same neighborhood. I made a great imaginative leap from changing Washington Manor, where we grew up, to Jefferson Manor. So that's the name there.
But you did it because of Thomas Jefferson, because he the landed yeoman versus the city dweller.
Yeah, I thought it worked well like that. But, yeah, I love Brian Copeland's show. I saw it years ago at the Marsh in the City, and I thought he so accurately nailed the kind of almost psychotic racism that permeated the town at that time. And his family, they were the pioneers of moving into what now is an extremely diverse community.
Well, you captured that almost psychotic racism also, but also the good ebullient sense that as I said, you know, it's sort of in the title, Lunch Bucket Paradise. You know, we associate lunch buckets with many working class. This isn't, you know, an argument for the proletariat or anything. It's just a kind of multidimensional view of what life was like then. In fact, I'm going to put it out to the listeners. I mean, so many of you baby boomers who are listening and those of you who grew up in the 50s and 60s have your own memories. And what those memories are and what those stories are is what I'd like us to explore in this hour and hear some of your stories about growing up and what it was like during the well, the Cold War period right after the Second World War, from the 50s to the 70s, which is really the time setting in Fred Sederberg's new novel, Lunch Bucket Paradise. I'm going to give out the number now, in fact. It's toll-free, and it's available to you. It's 866-733-6786, and feel free to join the program. Again, toll-free. You can do it now at 866-733-6786. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org. I'd like to hear some of your memories about the 50s and 60s and right up to the 70s, growing up in Northern California suburbs. You can also, of course, go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. And you can also communicate with us by going to our Facebook page. And we should mention, and some of you may want to bring some of these things up, that there's a lot of, for lack of a better word, and I know it's not necessarily a word that a serious novelist likes, but a lot of nostalgia in this novel. In fact, listeners may want to talk about those things, you know, Action Comics with Jimmy Olsen and Lex Luthor, The Battle of New Orleans, the lyrics of which I must confess I still remember. There's all that stuff about Betty Crocker and the Cisco Kid and Dacron. And I mean, just so many things that really punctuate a sense of that era.
Yeah, it's the little things that build the particulars of life, isn't it? And that was the era of innovation. You know, suddenly the new kings and queens of the castle have their own 1,100 square foot home, and then weekends to go out there and make it their own. You know, so that they aren't little houses of ticky-tacky that all look just the same, but they have.
Well, that was supposed to be Daly City,
right? I know, but you know, you can. Use the same epithet to so many suburbs. But what strikes me is how much energy people put into making their place their own, building a little fish pond outside, something my dad did, or planting all the time because we lived in a garden.
And there's a lot about gardening and maintenance, home maintenance. And I mean, this was really the core of American values in that period, your home, your garden, if you had one, your neighborhood.
Right. Well, just think of where we are in American history at that point, right? People had come out of the Depression losing their property. They had spent 4 years away from home, so many, and now returned, they have a piece of their own. You know, in what must have seemed unimaginable to so many people. I know it did in my folks. It was kind of a miracle to have this house.
I was also interested in the way the craft of this novel. You have little introductory sections that are italicized that really are much more general and maybe macrocosmic, for lack of a better word. And you also have some photographs in here.
Yeah, we do. And that's why it appears to be a novel in that way as well. Each chapter is broken up by a period photograph. So in the first chapter that talks about World War II a great deal, there's a young sailor, kind of tough-looking guy, scowling at the camera. And he looks like my character, Wynne, the uncle in the novel. But in fact, he's the father of a close friend of mine. We grew up together. A lot of the photos are friends' photos that they loan me because I like the period snapshot, you know, the unprofessional photograph that's kind of jiggled a little bit, off kilter, maybe an arm is cut off on the side. But it's that moment of truth that we look at and we see, oh, yes, that was my first communion. I can remember the sound that the dress made when it crinkled. I can remember standing there in that suit. I was so hot. And when would it be over?
Some funny stories about, catechisms and Catholicism. The boy is only known as Slick. The kid, the boy, goes through a lot of these early religious trainings, even though his father, as you say, is a skeptic and was raised as a Protestant and Catholic in Canada, excuse me. But he's getting the truth according to his priest is getting the truth about what happens if you're a good, pious Catholic boy. It reminded me a bit of James Joyce, actually.
Yes, I play around with that long speech in Portrait of the Artist where the priest is doing a lecture trying to convey how long eternity would be, and it's every million years
exactly
a bird
what it
comes.
Reminds me of, yeah.
And so I have the priest instead send a family off to Mount Lassen to pick up a piece of dirt and come back on their station wagon. It was just sort of a conscious echo of that. I'm glad you saw that.
You also have the priest talking about the delivery boys and, I mean, the newspaper boys, the ones who got hurt because they weren't good enough and the ones who didn't get hurt who were good enough, all that fate story about God playing a way in their lives. You know?
Right.
I mean, this is the kind of stories, I think that resonates for probably people not only brought up Catholic but any religion, really.
Yeah, this is pre-Vatican Council Catholicism, too. You know, so it's a little darker. It's a little more medieval, where you go through the lives of the saints and meditate upon the spiked wheel that killed St. Catherine or St. Lawrence being barbecued and being asked to turn me over. I'm done on that side. You know, this kind of weird sadomasochism that infused the lives of children at the time. I presume it doesn't any longer, but that's why it seemed like kind of a shrouded Gothic world to be sent into each Sunday.
Well, there was also the fascination these kids had with all this violence from the war and from Absolutely. What they learned about the martyrs and the saints and so forth. We're talking to Fred Sederberg. His novel is Lunch Bucket Paradise, and his essay stories and journalism have appeared in many magazines. He's a former staff writer for the East Bay Express, and asking listeners to really summon forth some of your memories and stories from this period. What makes this period distinct in your mind would be really another question that I'd like to throw out there. The period of the Cold War, the period that baby boomers grew up in the suburban world of Northern California in the 50s and 60s. In fact, let's bring some of our callers in, and we'll go first to Bruce. Good morning. Yeah, Bruce, are you there?
Oh, yes. I'm sorry, Mike. Yeah, I'm just helping my dad into the hospital here. But, you know, it's funny because he designed and built the house that I grew up in Tiburon in the 1950s. And Tiburon, I don't know if a lot of your listeners realize this, but Tiburon in the 1950s was much different kind of a town. It was a rural town. It still had a railroad. It still had dairy farms. It was very much working-class town, and it was transitioning at that time in the 50s and 60s into this beautiful, affluent suburb, which it now has become. And I got to grow up in that era, which was really a fascinating time because, you know, you grew up with the same kids. The parents all knew each other. We all did things together, and it was a wonderful community.
Did you call your neighbor's parents Mr. and Mrs., by the way?
Yeah, we did.
Okay.
We did. Yeah, we did. And there were very few families that, you know, seemed to be split up. The first divorce that happened, my best friend across the street, and it was such a shock, you know, this was 1963 or 64. So I'm loving the stories that your guest has today. I think it's a great introduction to a lot of people who maybe not from the area, just how different this part of the country was back at that time. And it was a wonderful experience to grow up in Marin County in the 50s and 60s and early 70s. My sister had horses. The Little League, you know, was very prominent. There were all sorts of activities with sailing, with camps. It was a very sweet, very, very almost, like a bubble type of distance in a way that doesn't exist too much anymore.
Well, thank you, Bruce, for those memories. Of course, that lousy phone line reminded me of how we used to have party lines even in those days. I mean, getting into some arcane memories here. But, you know, before we went on the air, Fred asked me, did a lot of this resonate for you growing up blue collar in Cleveland? And, of course, a lot of it did. But so many little things like hiding in the trunk to get in a drive-in movie. I mean, that young people can remove. The once young people who we're talking about here can remember. Let me go to more of your calls. And there's a caller from the East Bay, Alameda. Margaret, hi.
Hi, this is Margaret. Glad to be here. I grew up in San Lorenzo Village and went to village school, and it was a tight little ticky-tack community. And one of the favorite memories I had growing up was the 4th of July. Back then, we were allowed to buy fireworks, and I lived in a cul-de-sac. And all the families would bring their packs of fireworks, and we would each share with everybody else. And it was fun watching the bottle rockets go off and the twirlies on the trees and hoping that bottle rocket didn't set Mr. Smith's house roof on fire and things like that.
They weren't illegal.
No, they were not illegal. We could buy it right down the at the local corner. So we all enjoyed that a lot. And the other memory, of course, was at village school, the nurse's station, when we all marched together to get our first polio shots.
Yeah, I was talking to, thank you for that, the biographer of, woman who's writing a biography of Jonas Salk, and all that, of course, Philip Roth had a recent novel all about polio, but all that coming back to my memory, March of Dimes, and, you know, the fear of iron lungs and wheelchairs and everything. It's a little maybe early for you as a baby boomer, but you remember that?
No, I remember the parade to Corvallis School to get the Salk vaccine.
But that was for the – was that the Sabin or the – was that was the Sabin, the oral thing? Or the,
well, my notes were poor in that era.
Did you have banking? Did you, in elementary school, did you go, like, put a couple bucks in every month? And,
well, I think it was a dime, but yeah, now that you mention it, we did, right?
Yeah, it might have been a dime. I don't even remember how much it was. We had E.J. Dion on, and he was talking about humanitarian ideals as opposed to this kind of hyper-on-steroid individualism that we now see so rampant. And the individual ethos, I guess you could call it. There's a section in your book where you talk, where we get this whole little almost sermon about the ants. The worker never had it so good, but we think about ants as being workers. And talk about that. I mean, I was really struck by that. Ants don't work alone.
It's a little riff, one of those ones where we back away from the story that you were talking about, an italicized section. And we see the ants out there doing their work in the garden. And it ends saying an ant alone is an ant in trouble. And I think that was an ethos that was part of life in the blue-collar suburb. I know when I saw Billy Elliot, the movie, the first time, I was so moved by it. My wife and I came out and I was in tears. And it took me a while to really put my finger on what it was. But if you remember in the movie, if I'm getting this correctly,
I remember a lot of dancing, mainly.
Well, the miners in this town come together to give the kid, the dancing kid, enough money to go to London and become a dancer.
Right.
Or go to school, whatever happens. And that sense of the kids on the block are our kids was what I also grew up with. Part of it was a function of size, that these suburbs were then functioning more like small towns. But I also think it was class solidarity. I mean, a word that I'd never heard till I went to college, right? But I experienced it. And there a sense that we stand with each other to make sure that we have a decent place to live. And that means a degree of sacrifice, too. And we do it together because we know that we will sink unless we swim together.
Yeah, that was an undergirding value. I think that's right. You know, as I said, we could wax nostalgic and sentimental about it, and innocent times and halcyon times and all that. But there was that sense of pride in the neighborhood and looking out for one's, not only one's own kids, but the kids of one's neighbors. And that's that spirit, really.
Exactly. Know? And because, you know, I talk about lunch bucket paradise. And, of course, paradise, there's always a serpent in paradise. And these are people who are aware of the serpent raising his head at some point, you know, the disruption of life, the way history will streak in the center and blow everything up, fact that we're simply mortal and life isn't perfect.
But there weren't those kind of stories that you now have, kids disappearing and being taken off the streets and not being able to walk to school and all that sort of thing. They just didn't happen back then. Or if they did, we certainly were not aware of them.
No, and we didn't have 24-hour TV shows that would find each one in the country and show that over and over and over again.
Again, we're talking with Fred Sederberg, local author, his new novel, Lunch Bucket Paradise. And he says here, the working man never had it so good. And that's kind of one of the themes of this novel. You may have memories very different than that or very similar to that if you came up in Blue Collarville of whatever neighborhood here in Northern California, but we'll find out some more about your memories when we return on Forum. And again, you're listening to Forum discussing, well, life in Bay Area suburbs in the 50s and 60s. Fred Sederberg grew up in a blue collar neighborhood in San Leandro in a time of what I think can best be characterized as working class prosperity. Even worked at worked at a ketchup factory. I mean, how many ketchup factories are still around in Northern California? I don't know. More of this when we return. On Forum, I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with Fred Sederberg, who is a Bay Area author and has a new novel out called Lunch Bucket Paradise about, well, what some feel are happy days. We had Gary Marshall on recently. I think weren't such happy days, really. In fact, there was, as you realize when you read Fred Sederberg's novel, or you realize if you lived through those days, a great deal of dragon stuff under the surface or stuff that was under the cauldron of the happy sheen of life that perhaps existed in many people's minds in that era. But there were many things about that era, of course, which one can get quite sentimental about and one can wax nostalgically about. And we're sort of doing both here. I want to get more of your calls on here, but first I want to mention that Fred Sederberg is going to be making a couple of appearances. He's going to be at the Steinbeck Center in Salinas on July 6th. That'll be at 7 p.m. Friday night. And at the Livermore Public Library, which is one of the finest libraries, in my judgment, in the Bay Area. It's a beautiful library in the town of Livermore. He'll be there next month. In August, August 19th at 2 o'clock. Right. So I'm going to mark that down on your calendars. And let's go to more of your calls. We'll go to Richmond. Gil, hi.
Hello, Michael and guest. I grew up in Oakland, born in Oakland, and I remember going to Livermore. And I'd like to share the unbelievable changes in Livermore since the 1930s when I would go to visit my grandparents' house from East Oakland. We would drive. It would take us all day to go out and have Thanksgiving dinner with my grandparents out there. And at the end of Tesla Road, near the border, and when I visited them, when I went out there to look for the old ranch a few years back, everything in the world has changed. The ranch was about 4 miles from the flagpole in downtown Livermore. And now it was all dry and arid. It was dry wheat farming, a very, very tough existence. Now when you go out there, you'll see rusted farm implements thrown here and there. But before that, you'll get to the vineyards, all green and nice and irrigated with groundwater. But back in the 30s, one thing my sister and I would just look forward to the coyotes that were displayed dead on the barbed wire fences. We would go there maybe once a year, and we would hear the stories about the coyotes raiding the chicken house. But, you know, I can't believe how much changed in that time in Livermore. To me, it's just awesome. They still have, this is so far out from the center of town that to this day, to my knowledge, they still don't have full-service telephone, and yet it was only 4 miles from the flagpole.
Well, you're reflecting pretty nostalgically here, Gil, and certainly what comes across in your characterizations is the immense changes that have occurred, which is really what we are talking about, and I thank you for that. In fact, here's a comment on our web which says, our website, this sounds like a good companion piece to Season of the Witch, which I found very interesting, but a little too Whiggish, Things Progress, a similar book written by someone who, like the old working-class religious San Francisco, would be very different, and perhaps this has a bit of that flavor. Mind you, I'm one of the counterculturers who might not come out looking that good from that other point of view, but because I am one, I see the need for fairness and accuracy in history. And I think this is a fairly accurate rendering of history you give us here, recreating even the vernacular of your day, and a lot of the details in the book I found quite impressive. Also, we were shifting not only between wars, we were shifting in terms of race and more racial acceptance, despite what you characterized before as that almost psychotic racism that existed. But the soundtrack of the baby boomers of the 50s, 60s was really soul music.
Absolutely. It was Motown. Yeah. Isn't that funny? I mean, it's now the music for every backyard barbecue over the 4th of July. But Motown was the music of the civil rights movement, and it was in the background as the cities were burning in the late 60s. Detroit, Motown, chief among them. There's a chapter in the book where I talk about how important black music was to the white kids in this neighborhood I'm writing about. I mean, that contradiction was, you know, so glaring that people loved black music and that
they didn't want any blacks in their neighborhoods, though.
No, just the sound.
There's also a lot about the Boy Scouts, and the Boy Scouts were very important then. I think people, especially young kids now, tend to look at the Boy Scouts very differently. They were an important organization that you wanted to join and be part of.
You did, and I think they provided this transitional bridge between generations, because you had so many of the fathers of suburbia who had grown up on the farm or who had grown up duck and deer hunting, and now they were living someplace where you didn't carry your shotgun and your deer rifles around and quickly get out there in the woods, but you could make some introduction to the woods with your kids. The danger was that sometimes that turned into a kind of paramilitary parody, and you'd spend up your days marching back and forth and all this kind of drilling that seemed like you were getting ready to join the the special forces.
My friend Henry Miller from Hoover is going to put out a caveat if I say anything negative about DDT, but this is like pre-Rachel Carson that you're writing about. There's a lot of bug spray and a lot of pesticides used. I mean, people don't even realize to what extent and degree they were, especially if you had a garden in those days.
Yeah, can't you actually still smell it? you smell it and you feel it sort of in the back of your throat, this iron tang of that ortho spray out there to get rid of those bugs in the roses.
Well, you brought it back. Let me bring some of our callers forward. Peter, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. Yeah, my deceased girlfriend grew up in Burlingame, and she always would tell me about an unwritten law that blacks weren't allowed to own homes there. And to this day, it seems like the quintessential lily white bedroom community. And I just don't want to sound too controversial, but
no, but there were covenants. There were actual covenants that existed back in that era, And in fact, I think William Rehnquist, the former Supreme Court justice, owned a home with a covenant that came into no blacks or Jews. It was simply that way. I'll tell students it was that way in fraternities and sororities. They look at me with disbelief, but it was throughout the United States. Let me thank the caller. Yeah, Burlingame's still pretty lily white. A lot of these suburban areas have stayed pretty lily white.
The neighborhood I'm writing about in the town
is diverse now. Yeah.
Very diverse. And and I remember even growing up that while it was largely a white community, I would hear spoken in my friends' homes Tagalog, Chinese, Yiddish, German, Russian, of course Spanish and Portuguese. So it was a different community then, too, and doesn't – of course, anytime we try to fit a community or a way of life into a nice little square, that these were the ideal times, people never had it so good. That may be true, but, we're human, and all the imperfections of life, the fact that we'll die, all these things are always – they're with us, and they're with us in those – in the little houses made of ticky-tacky, too, which is something I think that fired me to want to write this book, that you could walk – I remember walking by – these neighborhoods as a kid and looking at the houses because there's no street life, right? It's the terrible thing about suburbia, except for the kids outside playing. There's no place where people gather into a central area. That's why you go to the city when you grow up in the suburbs. But I would look there and think, what's going on in those houses? What's ticking inside there? And it's always a mystery. And it's like each little house was like an individual brain, the universe inside of it.
Let me get more callers. Charles, join us. You're on.
Oh, yeah. Hi. Good
morning. Hi.
Okay. I've been here over 30 years in San Francisco, and I'm a baby boomer and grew up in the 50s and 60s. And but I'm going to talk about the East Coast, and, I give the heads up to your person answering the phone, so I think it's okay to talk about the East Coast. Western Connecticut is...
We're not regionally discriminating here. Please, talk about
Western,
the East Coast.
Northwestern Connecticut is a very beautiful area. It's hilly. It's part of the Appalachian Trail. And right along the, New York State border, eastern side of New York and the southern side of Massachusetts. Beautiful country. And it was like Norman Rockwell growing up there. I moved there in 1960 after my mother died. I moved in with my grandmother, me and my five sisters, and it was a lot different than New York. I was born in New York City, and we had a lot of fun. There were brooks, there were rivers, there was train tracks, there was all kinds of places we can explore and get into trouble. I had some friends up the hill who had. Father had somehow obtained two original German helmets, and when we played Army, everybody wanted to be the bad guys because they wanted to wear the helmets, going into this is New Milford, Connecticut. Going into that town, it was just Route 7 was the main, two-lane road. It was just farm after farm, cornfields, cows, and I haven't been there in about 10 years, and a lot of those cornfields and cows are gone, and a lot of malls and strip malls and things, it's all changed. But my son grew up here in San Francisco. He's just in his last year at San Francisco State, and he grew up mostly in the other Richmond district out near the Cliff House. So, you know, I spent a lot of time out there near the golf course, and, you know, we pretty much know that area, you know, inside out. But I kind of pined for him to be able to have, you know, some of the freedom and, you know, that I had, which you really can't get in the city. But it was a fun time, you know, I have to admit.
Well, you speak wistfully about it. It's almost moving to hear, particularly you wanting your son to experience what maybe can't be experienced, but I thank you for the call. I wonder, in fact, if others who lived along the eastern seaboard or lived in the big areas in the Northeast realize to what extent not only the change from the rural or the pastoral, almost the bucolic, to the urban, but how once the urban changes took place, there was a kind of white flight to the suburban areas. I mean, that's true about so many of the big cities in the East.
Right. Well, of course, the model for the kind of suburb we're discussing is Levittown, New York.
Yeah.
And then Pennsylvania. I have a friend who grew up there, and her father was a college professor. And from what she tells me, it was a much more a middle class area. And I'm writing about a blue collar town, and there really is a distinction, right? And this is a time when I think people spoke of themselves as being working people, were blue collar. They experienced in a daily way the fact that you could, when you came home, you were dirty. And you had sweated through the day, and there was always the prospect that you were going to get hurt at work, which seemed to me to be some of the bellwether qualities of blue-collar life.
Well, you mentioned Cheever before, and certainly when you think of suburbs in American literature, you think of Cheever, or Opdyke for that matter, and those are very different worlds. Those are much more bourgeois and even upper middle class to some degree. The only one who comes to my mind who I think caught the blue-collar world was Raymond Carver.
Carver. I really like Richard Price's early books,
too. Yeah,
too.
In fact, forgive me, Richard Price, who's a friend, sort of, for forgive. But, I mean, there are other writers like that. But most of the identification with, I mean, The Wanderers, in fact, which Phil Kaufman made in a movie, was
right.
Really a blue-collar novel.
Yeah.
But most of those writers that we associate with the suburbs are essentially very gilded kind of upper middle-class suburbs.
It's true, and I feel like this is part of the lost history of the late 20th century. As we hear again in political discourse that this is a middle-class nation, and the truth is that it's a nation that aspires to be middle-class. And working people want their kids to move ahead, but their existence, it's quite different to work with your body and skill too, because that's a big part of it too. The folks in our town were carpenters, plumbers. My dad was a sheet metal worker. These are difficult jobs that take a lot of smarts as well as brawn.
And we go to more of our callers. Let's go to Pleasant Hill, a suburb name I've always thought epitomizes some of what we're talking about. Hi, Steve, you're on.
Hi, Michael. Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I grew up, I was born in 51 in Chicago. My mother moved out here immediately afterwards. We moved into a $19,000 home on 39th Avenue in San Mateo. And amazingly priced at the time. It just resold here about 10 years ago for $1.2 million. So there kind of tells you the trend. But I grew up in San Jose right about the time it was starting to suburbanize. And at the time, it was called the Valley of Heart's Delight. It was not called Silicon Valley. And in fact, Silicon was, you had to go look that up if you wanted to know what that had to, you know, where that came from. So, but it was, we were in a little pocket of suburbia out in the middle of basically prune and plum orchards. And it was a kind of an eerie experience because you could ride about two blocks on your bike and you were in farmland. Very strange.
Well, thank you for those memories. Good to hear from you. I'm wondering if we can hear from Fred Sederberg a little bit since your last book was on immigrants in this area. What do you see as the changes in, say, the working class now other than obviously the different ethnic mix from the working class you grew up?
Well, the chief thing is this sense of possibility and expansion. You know, my book runs from 1950 to 1970. It's 1975, I think, is the point where wages flatten and then never recover. And in a sense, these kinds of communities never recover. Someone told me some years ago, a reporter, she was in the same community I'm writing about, she had done some reporting about the kids who were hanging out in the park and how those kids talked about the golden days of their parents' upbringing. And the difference, I think, was that it mirrored America's entire sensibility at the time, that we were moving out into the world and there was really nothing that we couldn't do, right, in the most exaggerated sense. These are also people in a blue-collar community who have a sense of limits. You know, they know from their experience that not everything is possible. Everything wasn't possible in their lives. But given the right circumstances, and this is what I think is crucial, given the right kind of choices that is supporting the kind of institutions that make a difference, primarily education, that then their kids are going to be able to move out into a different world. I'm struck by the difference in choices that are being made right now, that the family I grew up in revered FDR. I don't really recall a time when I didn't know that Fallow is their little dog. And when I was young enough, I was a little vague about was FDR still president? He was such a big force in that town. And it was because of the enormous difference that my family had come from really rural penury, you know, losing everything during the Depression, to now once again being homeowners in skilled jobs who are now going to be building these schools, a state college system, a state university system that I and my friends and so many of us were going to be able to attend virtually for nothing, and it would transform our lives. Isn't that just so strikingly different from what we experience today?
Yeah, in fact, tomorrow, Dave Iverson's talking to a filmmaker who has done a film on Pat Brown, Jerry Brown's father, and just think about the chasm between all that was built during that era and the difficulty in just, getting away from this big deficit now. Email from Cheryl. Speaking of lunch buckets, is there anything as special as snapping open a warm tin box to release the odor of a warming bologna and mayo on white bread sandwich perfectly wrapped in wax paper and the faint smell of nearly curdled milk? If ever I encounter that odor again, it will make me smile. Mindy in San Jose writes, I was born in 55 and remember when we would come home from school in the 60s, we would actually change into our play clothes. We all went outside and played on our bikes in the park. We ran around. All the kids in the block would come out. It was fun. Kids today need to get away from the video games and go outside and play. And here's Jerry, who says, I'm from the same generation as Fred, but I grew up in East Orange, New Jersey. There weren't any farms close to me. I'm wondering if Fred has any experience with this generation from the East Coast.
Well, I have an whole East Coast family. My Italian mother has she had a sprawling wave after wave of cousins, some of whom I've yet to even meet. But, yeah, I felt like I had a kind of bi-coastal experience growing up in my mother's imagination of the East, though she left the East when she was 29, I guess.
But still flooded your consciousness.
Yeah.
So. Another email comment. Interesting question Charles raising. Does anyone know what the psychological role is of nostalgia? Comes up in this book, but also equally in travel, life insurance, and political commercials, Reagan, Morning in America, and right-wing politics, traditional family values. It's all seen through a fuzzy lens. You've mentioned the racism and sexism, but note it appears you're not getting African-Americans or Latinos calling in with their memories, which might be quite different. Alcoholism? What does the book say about the undersides of the old world of the peninsula?
Well, I really agree with that. I mean, I think nostalgia can be a really pernicious force. And in this book, I'm trying to portray as accurately as I can the felt experience. I doubt that many people during the 50s and 60s went around throughout the day thinking, this is the best of all possible worlds, and I'm realizing my potential to the fullest at each moment. This is sort of a silly notion. We look back on it, and it's easy to see the things we lost, but you know, we have to remember these were 1,100 square foot homes, right? There was a kind of built-in sense of modesty, I think, about what was possible and what was right. You know, in my family, and I think from so many people in the neighborhood, people would have said, a 4,000 square foot home? Well, you know, what are you going to do with that? You're going to keep cattle in there? What's the point?
There's also the college dream I keep thinking about. You know, I mean, I had an uncle who said to me, you're going to be a college graduate. You know, and that carried so much weight in those days. Yeah. It was like, and there was no question, now with many friends who've gone places like Harvard and Princeton, but there was never any question. You were a working class kid. You went to a state school.
I mean, that's right.
Your choices were really limited, with few exceptions. Yeah. Web comment. I grew up in upstate New York, and my life was so similar. Metal banks from the bank to encourage saving. Hearing that we didn't know how good we had it from the Depression-era parents. The local swimming hole. Being told that I could hope for no more than purgatory for my predominantly Catholic neighbors. Taking buses to the city to a different school each year because there was no school system in the suburbs. Iron lungs still in my first few years after nursing school. Thanks for the memories. Another email comment, listener writes, I live in the Estudio Estates neighborhood of San Leandro that was almost entirely white but now is very diverse. I'm an African-American man married to a Caucasian female and have many neighbors same sex. Things have dramatically changed, as the old-timers in the neighborhood will tell you. Another web comment, not to belabor the point, but to what extent was the near-psychotic racism of a piece with keeping the neighborhood good? I do not mean to imply that the two were the same, but in the minds of the adults...
I think that was the language that was used for sure.
A lot of fear of property value going down, though, too, wasn't there? I mean, that's what I remember about all white neighborhoods.
Again, that was the way it was expressed. I think there was a deep fear of the other that, you know, you just can't get away from that. And you know, we lived in a pre-civil rights movement. We lived in a different America. We lived in apartheid America. I think it's almost unimaginable to people who didn't live through that period about what the changes from, you know, before SNCC in 1964 and afterwards.
More of your calls. To Nevada we go. Mark, hi.
Hi, this is Mark from, I'm actually from Sacramento. I was in Nevada. I grew up for a large part in the early 50s in Livermore, when it was still something of a small town, but it was growing greatly. My dad worked in the radiation lab. And one of the things that is a memory, I think, to many people from that era were the bomb drills that you'd have in school, where they'd have you hide under your desk and protect yourself from the atomic blast.
Duck and cover.
Excuse me?
That's what it was called, duck and cover.
Duck and cover.
You go under the desk and all you'd see is gum under the desk. But yeah.
We had more than that in Livermore, though. We actually had spotters. We had airplane spotters that were on these little elevated stages, and we could go up and watch them. And they had these outlines of Russian bombers so that they could spot the bombers and do something about it. And I don't know what that was all about. But it was a very vivid part of my life. I think... probably at that time there were more young professionals than it was blue collar just because of the lab. But there was still a sense of, as I recall, a sense of cohesiveness. I mean, everybody was virtually the same in terms of their class. When you go to school, there wasn't anybody that was rich or poor.
Well, you went to a different school than I did. I mean, I don't know what it was like for you, Fred. Do you want to talk about that? I mean, the high school I went to, there were those of us who were kind of in the working class neighborhood, and then there were kids over in a place called University Heights who were somewhat more affluent, better off. Really.
Yeah, this was a small community, so there was something, a division line, but for the most part, it was pretty homogeneously blue-collar. People who had educations and middle-class jobs, they moved on. People who were unemployed and poor, they disappeared. And there were the poor families that you would see for 6 months out of the school year, and then suddenly those children are gone. And I remember that happening again and again, because although these were homes that sold for $5,000, that was a lot of money if you were doing janitorial work or if you were doing non-unionized work. It was tough to hold on.
There were people in my neighborhood who it wasn't uncommon to have boarders. You know, if you had an extra bedroom or if you had – that's still the case, of course, I'm sure, throughout the country. But even an attic – where you could put somebody, you know, in one of these houses, or a basement. You did, because you needed the money. We'll go to San Francisco. Phil, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Okay. I was born and raised in San Francisco. We moved from the Fillmore to Glen Park in 1952. That was before there was a Diamond Heights. There was still a horse up there in a former dairy farm. And it seemed to me like it was a step down for the Irish in the Noe Valley, and a step down for the Italians in the Excelsior, and a step up for the Latinos in the Mission. And I'm Latino, by the way. And the richest kids on the block were like, the father was a barber and the other was a fireman. And my wife still lives in Glen Park. I bought a house around the corner from my father and I got divorced. She still has a house. And it seems kind of yuppie. On her block, there's two lawyers and two doctors. She's the last blue collar working there, and things have really changed in Glen Park. It was before the highways and the BART, and there was still jackrabbits in our backyard, and oh, Jesus, like a wilderness out there.
A different world.
Yeah, completely different from when I grew up. As a kid, I went to Glen Park School, went to all the schools around there, and I would never have thought that house that my father bought for $14,000, a big house with a vacant lot, he would have kept it, we'd be millionaires.
Well, thank you for that. I think my dad paid $12,000 for the first home he bought, which was soon after I was born, and had to borrow money, obviously, to
right.
do it, which wasn't uncommon.
Well, you know, one of the big differences, Michael, there's a scene in the book where two of the teenage boys they're putting a new roof on the house, and they're on their family's house, and they're looking out over the skyline of the East Bay, and what they see is the smoke belching from the canning factories in Hayward, and they're looking out at Brockway Glass and the Ford Assembly Plant, Caterpillar, all of this infrastructure of heavy industry that was the basis for the prosperous life there. And almost one by one, you can tick through these things that no longer exist. They're empty spaces now. They're places where homes are. And that's one of the vast changes, too, is not just the loss of the green space, but the loss of the industrial infrastructure of the Bay Area.
Obviously, this is more than a book about nostalgia. It's a very serious book. It's called Lunch Bucket Paradise, and I enjoyed it. I enjoyed a lot of the humor in it, too. And
thank you for being with us. Thank you.
And you can meet, actually, Fred Sederberg at the Steinbeck Center in Salinas, July 6th at 7 p.m. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Amanda Stupai, and Tina Larberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll, and our engineer is Howard Gilman. Our executive producer, Raul Ramirez. And let's thank our present interns, Asal Asanipour, Jessica Chung, Emily Holtzman, Shelby Pope, and Joshua Rafeman, with help this week from Max Root. For all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg.